On this week's 51%, we bring you a story about eating disorders in the military.
So it's just the setup for the person to be actively engaging in their eating disorder and not getting any kind of help.
And we have a subject few want to talk or hear about, but the statistics will make women pay attention: urinary incontinence. You'll also hear from a woman on an audio mission. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Before we get to the story on eating disorders in the military, here's a bit of military news. Transgender people will now be allowed to serve openly in the U.S. military. Defense Secretary Ash Carter recently made the announcement at the Pentagon, saying it's the right thing to do. He said, quote, "Americans who want to serve and can meet our standards should be afforded the opportunity to compete to do so," end quote. Carter laid out a one-year plan to implement the change, which will end one of the last bans on service in the military. In December 2015, Carter said that women in the U.S. military, including the Army and Marines, can now serve in combat posts. And now to our story. In recent years, military doctors have become more aware of eating disorders among service members. A Department of Defense report concluded that conditions like anorexia and bulimia occur in the military with surprising frequency. American Homefront reporter Patricia Murphy looked into why.
At 23, Marine Lieutenant Teresa Larson was in Fallujah, Iraq, with a platoon of 54 Marines, most of them men. It was 2005. She was escorting female insurgents and leading convoys. Larson was also living with bulimia, binging on whatever was around.
So you have buffets when you're in on the base, but then like when you're off base and doing convoys, there's MREs. So whatever was available, you just eat too much of it. Whatever could be consumed could be thrown up.
Like many people with eating disorders, Larson's evolved over time. As a young Marine, she had dieted down to a super lean physique, but eventually she started to gain weight.
It wasn't a lot, but you can still tell going from super lean to more average size. And when you're in a male-dominated world, they see that. And I didn't want to show weakness. Heading to war, I can't screw up. I had to be perfect.
Larson saw a mental health counselor in Iraq, but he didn't help.
It was like, you're throwing up? Like, why would you do that? I began to realize, like, okay, no one understands this.
Larson knew she was out of control. Her eating disorder had taken over. Larson told her commander she needed to get out of Iraq to get well. She was medically evacuated from Fallujah and started treatment, but was forced to leave the Marines.
So even going from being a very good Marine, taking care of her Marines, all of a sudden she needs to be cared for. Well, too bad. So sad. We need to get you out. We don't know what the hell's wrong with you, and you're a liability now.
A Department of Defense report in 2013 found more than 3,500 service members were diagnosed with eating disorders over the previous 10 years. As a young female Marine, Larson was part of the highest risk group. Many more cases likely were undiagnosed.
The eating disorder really grows in these really dark and secretive places.
Dr. Neeru Bakshi is medical director at Eating Recovery Center in Bellevue, Washington, an intensive outpatient and residential treatment facility. She says service members face a perfect storm of risk factors for eating disorders. There's combat stress, intense pressure to perform, and strict weight limits.
They will actually use their eating disorders to support what they need for those physical requirements. We'll have vets that come to us saying, well, prior to my needing to meet X and Y and Z for my physical requirements test, I was in the gym 6 hours a day. And that's actually a form of their eating disorders.
And part of the problem, Bakshi says, is that it works for them. The thinner, leaner troops tend to get ahead. The heavier ones might get reprimanded. And Bakshi says the armed forces do a poor job providing early intervention for troops who start to develop eating problems.
Within the military, there's this lack of awareness and lack of support that's available for the ongoing treatment. So it's just this setup for the person to be actively engaging in their eating disorder and not getting any kind of help.
That's what Colette Candy is trying to change. She's a psychologist at Madigan Army Medical Center in Tacoma and is one of a handful who treat eating disorders. She says many soldiers she sees have kept their condition secret throughout their military careers.
Most people come after a 10, a 17, or recently 20-something year history of eating disorder behavior.
Candy is treating 10 soldiers, a caseload that's now large enough that she started her first eating disorder therapy group and added a dietitian to the care team. She can't help everybody. She says about a third of her patients have to seek a higher level of care outside the military. But Candy says she's also had remarkable successes.
You know, I had a guy with a 17-year-old history turn it around just by outpatient treatment. So you can never guess who's going to respond.
Welcome to Adaptive Strength today.
It took years, but Marine veteran Teresa Larson is one of those service members who did respond to treatment. A decade after her discharge from the Marines, she owns a physical therapy and wellness company in San Diego, and once a week teaches an adaptive exercise class to fellow vets.
We are doing a warm-up that involves med ball.
Larson says helping veterans who've lost limbs or are adjusting to other limitations is an important part of her life and her recovery. She says she hasn't purged in years, and now blogs and gives speeches about her experience with bulimia in the military.
I don't blame the Marine Corps for anything. I think things could have been much better, but that's why we're starting this conversation, to get people help before they're broken.
The Department of Defense report noted the military already has a way to identify people who might need that help, the regular height and weight assessments that are required of troops. It's a matter of making sure that commanders understand eating disorders and encourage those who need treatment. I'm Patricia Murphy reporting.
Urinary incontinence is more common than you think, but it's tough to talk about. Lauren Whaley reports on treatments and technologies and talks about her own case.
My has to pee in the toilet.
My son is 2, and he has mastered the toilet. He doesn't pee in his pants or wear diapers, but ever since he was born, I do. I'm 35 years old, and I buy diapers for myself.
Talking about incontinence is still one of those frontiers that's not really comfortable for many women to talk about.
That's Dr. Amy Rosenman.
I am a health sciences clinical professor at UCLA in the Department of OBGYN.
Some studies report that 1 out of 10 women my age are peeing themselves. Others say the numbers could be much, much higher. But it's tough to talk about. Peeing in your pants is embarrassing. I want to tell women that they don't have to suffer, that they're not alone. Medical professionals and a whole crop of new technologies can help. So, here's my story. I have what's called stress incontinence. Not from emotional stress, though leaking pee can cause that, but from the physical stress of coughing or jumping or wrestling and laughing with a 2-year-old. No, I'm not going to die from this, but it has changed my life. I stopped running, the activity that makes me sane, because I hated soaking through 2 pads and still coming home with wet shorts. For many women, it's a lot worse.
Severe incontinence, women stop traveling. They're embarrassed about their absorptive products and how they dispose of them, and it's major life-altering.
Urinary incontinence is what's known as a pelvic floor disorder. There are 2 other major ones. There's fecal incontinence, which is leaking poop, and organ prolapse, when the uterus or bladder or intestines actually start to sag and fall into the vagina. About 25% of American women have at least 1 pelvic floor disorder, and urinary incontinence is the most common. There are a ton of factors that contribute to leaking, so get ready for a long list. But first, a little more about the pelvic floor. The pelvic floor is a group of muscles in the shape of a basket. It's connected to the abs and cradles the bladder, intestines, and uterus. It helps control pee and poop and helps guide the baby out during childbirth. So, back to that list, the reasons someone might leak pee. For those of us that have had babies, hormonal changes, the weight of the baby during pregnancy, and childbirth injuries can weaken or damage the pelvic floor and cause leaking. Genetics and weaker pelvic muscle tissue can also make you more prone to leaking. Same if you're overweight or if you smoke. For older women, hormonal changes during menopause or just gravity taking over can cause leaking. And in some women, it's not muscular. The communication between brain and bladder breaks down and makes you feel like you gotta go right now. That's called urge incontinence, and it's more common in older women.
After age 60, greater than 30% of all women have some form of incontinence.
And after age 80, about 50% of American women leak pee. Lucky for us, younger and older, there's now an entire subspecialty in medicine built around treating pelvic floor issues. It's called urogynecology. There are also some new tech tools that have been added to the mix of treatments. Many of them are also used in pelvic floor physical therapy.
people are being a little bit more open about the fact that they're having trouble either with incontinence or even pelvic pain.
Amy Diaz is my physical therapist. She's a faculty member at the University of Southern California, Division of Biokinesiology and Physical Therapy. She also leaks urine herself. Her incontinence is from organ prolapse related to pregnancy.
Certainly, I understand the emotional side of it. I understand some of the physical symptoms.
And she's up on the latest technologies to help her patients.
So kegelme.com, have you seen this, the Kegel? So this is basically a interactive Kegel exerciser that can send information to your smartphone.
A Kegel is an exercise where you tighten your vagina and butt like you're stopping pee midstream. They don't take a ton of effort, but Diaz says many women don't know how to do them correctly. And that's where this device and others like it can help.
Can you describe what that looks like?
Oh, sure. So,
Just describe it.
So it looks a little bit like a dildo that you're going to insert. So as you tighten the muscles, it will cause the device to vibrate.
And all the data pop up on your smartphone via Bluetooth. But you don't have to buy a device that looks like a sex toy. There are tons of apps out there for tracking your pad usage and leaking, or reminding you to pee more frequently, or coaching you through exercises. This one is called Kegel Nation.
Contract your pelvic floor muscles and maintain them as tight as you can for as long as you can.
Thank you, Kegel Coach Meditation Man. I wonder how many of us are clenching our vaginas and butts at this exact moment.
Keep them tight, 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 tight.
Physical therapy and strengthening exercises can work. And there are other treatments too, like injecting Botox into the bladder to stop spasms, or inserting bulking agents into the urethra to beef it up.
Our field is changing rapidly, and I think that's what's fun about it. And from a prognosis perspective, I think we're only going to get better at treating these things.
Right. The new advances are exciting, but they're not going to cure everyone.
I run from, I'm in the pool. Sometimes I don't make it. Stand on the grass.
Take my friend Donna Miro. She is 70 years old and has two kinds of incontinence. She had surgery to install a big supportive mesh sling under her weakened pelvic floor muscles. That was to treat her stress incontinence, and the surgery worked. But she still has memorized the location of every McDonald's off of LA's East-West 10 freeway.
Because they're designed the same, and I know when you go in, you turn right, and there's a bathroom.
That's because her urge incontinence, where she suddenly has to go right now, is still a big problem, in spite of some pretty advanced technology. She had a small device surgically implanted in her back. It gives a little bzzz when her bladder is full, so her brain gets the signal, and she knows it's time to find a toilet. But she still soaks through 3 or 4 pads a day.
Okay. Here's a thick, thick pad.
Donna's urogynecologist says her only option may be more surgery.
I'm not willing to go through any really major surgery to correct this because there's no guarantee. And this is the best that anyone can do. And maybe science and technology will come up with something different.
Studies suggest that the number of American women with urinary incontinence will increase by 55%. In the next 35 years, due to an aging and increasingly overweight population. So innovators have their work cut out for them. But there is this new product on the market. It's for stress incontinence, so it won't help Donna, but it could help me get back to running. It looks like a tampon, but it's made out of silicone. It's called the Poise Impressa Bladder Support. It's inserted into the vagina and holds the urethra in place so it doesn't leak pee. Dr. Rosenman says it could be a game changer for women with severe stress incontinence, because even though strengthening exercises are great for mild cases, she says the only fix for terrible leaking is still surgery. The Impressa could be an alternative, and you can get it at the grocery store. Look, I don't want to leak pee, but I'm glad I'm leaking at this point in history. We have experts and inserts and apps. People are inventing stuff. We pants peers have options. Now, I gotta go. I'm Lauren Whaley. This program is part of the STEM Story Project, distributed by PRX and made possible with funds from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
This week, we bring you another installment of the 51% segment called Force of Nature from Dr. Sharon Ufberg. She is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in Napa Valley, California. She also blogs for the Huffington Post. This week, she interviews Terry Winston, executive director of Women's Audio Mission, a San Francisco-based nonprofit organization dedicated to the advancement of women in music and media production and the recording arts. Winston is a recording engineer, music producer, former major label recording artist, and former tenured professor and director of the Sound Recording Arts degree program at City College of San Francisco. Ufberg asked Winston about the importance of Women's Audio Mission.
It's important to me because there's two really critical issues out there that I don't think people are that aware of. And the first one would be that there's less than 5% women creating all of the sounds and the messages and the media that make up that constant soundtrack in our lives. So our women's ideas, perspectives, points of view, they're barely audible. And so that's one thing that I find to be kind of a crisis. And a second connected issue would be that a really disturbing statistic, a 70% decline in young women entering STEM or science, technology, engineering, and math college programs, and this is just since the year 2000. So it's a new problem, and it's not from the dark ages, and it's actually getting worse. And so by using music and media to get women and girls interested in production from a technology perspective kind of, you know, solves both of those issues. So that's why it's important to me and I think to most people.
And you've spent so much time in this world, probably as a minority, as a woman in the industry. I'd be very curious to get your perspective on, you know, what you think women will uniquely bring to this media production, how they will influence the sound by, you know, having more of us represented in that.
Well, I think anytime you bring diversity to a situation, it seeds innovation. So I think that's been proven. There's been many articles on that. So bringing more diverse perspectives to the table is always helpful. I know from my perspective of being typically the only woman in a room when something's being produced, it definitely just brings a different environment, and people are just more aware of what they're talking about and whether or not they're addressing. I mean, come on, we're over 50% of the audience. So if you're going, you know, the classic training would be to think about your audience. And I think when women aren't represented in the place where these pieces of media are being produced, we're not necessarily, the folks aren't necessarily thinking about that portion, that large portion of the audience, which isn't a minority, it's a majority. You know, that definitely gets thought of more clearly and more often.
Do you think there'll be actually a difference in the actual product? So will the sound be different, or would different pieces of the production be perhaps different emphasis based on the fact that it's a woman creating the sound structure?
Absolutely. I to the bottom of my heart, believe that. I think it will change it. I think it will revolutionize it. I think you'll see radical changes in what's represented, and it's just because that viewpoint hasn't been brought to the table.
Do you have any statistics about how many women are actually the singers, you know, or the musicians versus the people behind the scenes? I mean, is it more evenly balanced that in terms of the actual face of the music versus the production?
Yes, it is. But still, I think the statistic was something like, well, you can see this, like, I think it was 21% women were only, and I don't know these statistics, or I'm guessing here, but in most award categories, if you look at the Grammys or the Junos, or you look at the number of women that have bylines in media, there's that same. There's still not parity there. So that's still not great, but it is definitely better than on the production side. But, you know, what's interesting is, you know, I'm sure you've seen the articles about who's writing the songs, for instance, for Beyonce. So you're seeing the face as Beyonce, but you're also seeing, you know, 30-some people on the production team, mostly male. I think there was one woman.
So, right. The same was when you saw Taylor Swift stand up with – all of those men behind them, you know, at the award ceremony. That was a pretty graphic representation.
Exactly.
I think. So I so applaud the work that you're doing with Women's Audio Mission. Thank you so much, Terry. I look forward to coming and having a look around Women's Audio Mission myself sometime real soon. This is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Force of Nature for 51%.
Women's Audio Mission can be found online at womensaudiomission.org and on social media. Steven Spielberg, ahead of the summer season, premiered his first Disney film, The BFG. The film is based on a children's book from an especially scary genre of children's literature. It turns out gothic literature for kids is getting more and more popular. Lilia Fuchin finds out why.
Never get out of bed. Never go to the window. Never look behind the curtain. And that is where our story begins.
This is from the trailer of Spielberg's new movie, The BFG. Based on Roald Dahl's book, it promises suspense, surprise, even scary moments. But it's not the darkest of what children's books have to offer. And some folks are worried about that. What does it mean when children want to read dark, twisted tales like Lemony Snicket's? Rhonda Brock-Servais, a professor of children's and young adult literature at Longwood University, says there's no need to worry.
Kids are smart, and they understand fantasy as fantasy and reality as reality.
What characterizes a children's gothic or horror book?
You can identify them by a series of things, mostly children being unprotected in the world would be the key thing. But other elements like ghosts or empty houses or the presence of the past that has to be resolved before the child can go forward into the future.
Think everything from Wuthering Heights to Goosebumps to Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events to The Raven Boys. These are all in the pile of scary books for kids. And Rhonda says we're not really calling it children's horror anymore.
Horror is actually kind of on the outs. Gothic is more the word of the day for scary stuff for kids.
So why is it so popular? Rhonda says it's because we're in a very frightening cultural moment.
The world is a frightening place, right? You have this sort of permanent fear of somebody releasing a virus or another terrorist attack or Iran dropping a bomb on us.
And even though culturally we might want to protect the children, Rhonda says the truth of the matter is children exist in the same world adults exist in and have some knowledge of what's going on, even if they don't understand it.
And part of what scary literature can do, whether an adult or a child, is give you a scare that you can master to help build the psychological capacity to deal with fright.
Rhonda says that when you're reading a scary book or watching a scary film, you have total control. If it's too scary, you can put the book down or turn the film off. And this, she says, can be good exercise for a child.
Just being a child, I think, is to some degree chaos and insecurity. If for no other reason, then you're always under somebody else's control, even if that somebody else loves you. Eat your green beans, go to bed, do this, do that. No matter how much your parents love you, you are under their command. You are smaller, you are weaker. So saying in these scary books, sort of acknowledging, yes, you know, life can be difficult. Yes, it can seem like people are out to get you. And to provide that sort of reassurance that, yes, you'll get through it. You'll learn to deal with this.
For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Lilia Fuchin.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1408.